God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things.
On the program today, Pastor Larry Spargimino talks with host of American Minute and former congressional candidate Bill Federer about immigration. What happens when you try to sneak into Mexico? According to Mexican law, you face up to 2 years in prison and a fine of 300 to 5,000 pesos. It is also illegal for a foreigner to participate in any protest and is punishable by a prison term. Here now is Pastor Larry and Bill Federer.
Thank you, Marvin, and greetings to all of our listeners. It's a great, great privilege to be with you. Bill Federer is our guest, and we're going to be talking about illegal immigration, sanctuary cities, the refugee resettlement program, and we'll want to learn more about the U.S. State Department's billion-dollar refugee program. It's very, very costly, and there are lots of problems with it. Thank you, Bill, for being with us on this broadcast.
Great to be with you, Larry.
Well, let's start with the Muslim Refugee Resettlement Program. It's admitting thousands of potential jihadists into the country. I think it presents a significant national security risk. I know that many of our listeners are concerned, and I'm concerned. Are these concerns groundless, or do they have great merit?
Well, it's happening in America and also in the European countries that they're having large numbers of Muslim refugees flooding into these countries. And the countries are being nice and letting them in. And the problem is after they come in, they form communities, and then they begin to demand political accommodation, you know, don't offend them and get rid of your pork and so forth. And then they begin to agitate and demand the welfare and the Section 8 housing. And before you know it, they begin to want to take over neighborhoods and spread Islam. And so it's a interesting phenomenon that goes all the way back to Muhammad. And so when we understand Muhammad was a religious refugee, Muhammad was an immigrant. What do I mean? Well, originally, Muhammad was born in 570 A.D., around Mecca, and he lived in Mecca until 622 A.D., and he had fled because the people of Mecca were intolerant of his new religion. So a little background on Muhammad. He was a religious leader first, and then he became a political leader, then he became a military leader. As a religious leader, Muhammad was illiterate. He could never read and write, and he had gone with his father died before he was born. His mother died when he was 8 years old. His uncle died, who was his guardian, when he was 12 years old. So he was orphaned, but then he would go around with his uncle on camel rides, and they'd go to different cities and hear about different religions. And so he'd hear about the Jewish oral traditions, and some of those beliefs got reflected in his faith. He heard about some of the Zoroastrian beliefs that, you know, paradise was filled full of virgins and jinns and genies, and some of those got incorporated into Islam. There was some heretical Christian belief. Even Encyclopedia Britannica says the gospel was made known to Muhammad through apocryphal and heretical sources. So he thought the Trinity was the Father, Mary, and Jesus. Some of those got incorporated into his belief. And so all these things are in there. And, of course, he can't read. You say, well, how can somebody that can't read memorize all these verses? Well, in Arabic, they had a little rhyme, a little beat to them, very similar to rap music today. And so you have a student that maybe can't read, but they memorize these long rap songs. And anyway, and so Muhammad goes into Mecca, and he's real excited about his faith. And after 12 years, very few people join. And then he gets confrontational, and they chase him out of town for disturbing the peace. At this point, he tries to go to Al-Taif, a city to the south, and they pelt him with rocks, and they say, we don't want you. And so he goes north to a Jewish city of Medina. Three Jewish tribes control Medina. They were really nice. They let Muhammad in as an immigrant, as a refugee. And he is allowed to live amongst the minorities. He's there for a while, and he decides to organize the minorities and we're familiar with the term of organizing in the community, and he gets a following. He goes back to the Jewish leaders, presents himself as a candidate of change, that he's a newcomer to the politics of the city, and they make a treaty with him. Now he's a political leader, and then something happens. His followers get chased out of Mecca, like he was, as religious refugees, as immigrants. They're allowed into Medina, and then they begin to rob the caravans headed back to Mecca. And this is when Muhammad becomes a military leader, and he fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. Even uses the catapult when he attacked a city called Al-Ta'if. When they told him that the catapult was hurling these rocks and killing women and children, his response was, "They are among them." So they got to be killed too. And so within 5 years of Muhammad coming into the Jewish city of Medina, there's not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They were chased out, killed, or enslaved. And so within 5 years of Muhammad's death, every pre-existing culture in Arabia was wiped out. And so the Muslim pattern, like Caesar's pattern was Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered. The Muslim pattern is immigrate, increase, eliminate. Immigrate as a religious refugee into the host victim country, sort of in a parasitical type of fashion. And then you live off the life of that host country. You take their welfare, and, you know, they called it the golden age of Islam because they were living off the accumulated wealth of all the countries that they had conquered. And so they immigrate in, then they increase the number of their followers, and then they gradually eliminate the previous culture. I was in Detroit, Michigan, and a lady had a ministry to pregnant moms. And so she goes by a Muslim house, and she's bringing a little present. Well, out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom, and out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom, and out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom, all pregnant by the same man. He's practicing Sharia law in his house. And then someone comes by my book table, says, "Fazl bought a bunch of houses on the street, has a wife in each one." They go down to the welfare office, say, "My husband's not around," and they get checks. He goes and visits the wives. Then the more kids they have, the bigger the checks get. He's living like a king, and all the kids playing in the middle of the street are his kids. He's practicing Sharia law on his block. They take over several blocks, and they vote in the school board. So they have Sharia law in the school boards in Dearborn, Michigan, in the schools. And then they take over several more blocks, and they vote in the police department, the fire department. And before you know it, they have minarets and Islamic call to prayer 5 times a day on loudspeakers. And so the first ones came in as immigrants, and then they increased, and then they eliminated and drove out all the previous inhabitants of the neighborhoods. And so it's a three-step process. And so when we see that the immigrants that are being brought in to these European countries, they're not the Christian ones. The immigrants coming to America, they're not letting the Christians in. They're just bringing the Muslims in. And the first ones come in, and then they build communities, and then they begin to be politicized, and then they learn how to do the political system, and then they begin to get violent. And there's no witnesses because no Muslim will testify against another Muslim on behalf of a kafir infidel. And before you know it, they've taken over the neighborhood.
Well, when you speak about immigrate, increase, and eliminate, and then something that you had sent me speaks about hijra, immigration, that's actually a doctrinal imperative for Muslims. So this is part of their belief, and we see it being implemented before our very eyes right in our own country. And what I've noticed is that so many of the Somali immigrants who come to America, they're the ones who are trying to join ISIS. So they're here, but their hearts haven't been changed. They're really their hearts are with ISIS and with Islamic terrorism. So we have a major problem that our government doesn't seem to want to address at all.
Right, and the interesting thing is there's 8,000 Somali Muslims being moved into Cheyenne, Wyoming, and 10,000 Syrian Muslims being moved into Boise, Idaho, and they're wanting to bring 50,000 Syrian Muslims into Detroit, Michigan, in the downtown areas. And they're actually picking rural cities all across America, and you say, who's doing this? Well, it's the United Nations. There's a Resettlement Watch blog, Refugee Resettlement Watch, and a lady, Ann Cochran, was noticing that all of a sudden in her rural community, there's hundreds and hundreds of Muslims, and they've filled up and taken over the Section 8 housing, and they've taken over the schools, and the schools aren't equipped to take care of all these multi-languages, and then they are flooding into the hospitals for free medical care, and they're signing up for food stamps and so forth. And she's like, who is bringing them in? Well, she finds out it's some liberal Christian denominations that are working together with the federal government and with the United Nations. And you think, what? That's right. And once they agree to take the money, they can't present the gospel. And so they're just bringing them in, and there's no effort to evangelize them, no effort to assimilate them. They're just bringing them over and planting them here. And so they bring them over in such large numbers, they will never assimilate. They're going to keep their Islamic identity. And they take over area after area after area, and they begin to squeeze out the previous inhabitants of those neighborhoods. And then they go from the three steps of Muhammad. They go from being religious Muslims to political Muslims to militant Muslims. And the 1,400-year track record. And so we see that our government is specifically denying Christian refugees entrance into America, and the Muslim refugees they're bringing in, there is no background checks going on. There's no way of screening them to say, are you going to be loyal to America? Are you going to leave your jihad ways? And we're not doing any of that. We're just letting them in. So you can be pretty confident that we're actually bringing in terrorists into cities all across America. You add to that how they've infiltrated the drug gangs. And Hugo Chavez in Venezuela had been bringing Muslim terrorists over from Iran to Venezuela, teaching them Spanish, sending them north. And so there's increased numbers of Muslim populations in Latin American countries and South America and Colombia and Venezuela and Suriname and Tobago and Trinidad. And they are migrating north and infiltrating the drug gangs, as I mentioned, and they're showing up in all these different cities across America. And the thought is, are we being set up for an Arab Spring? Simultaneous Ferguson's and Baltimore's by rioting people in these cities. We lived a half an hour from Ferguson, Missouri, and they were holding up ISIS signs. And so the thought is, why would we do this? Well, in the midst of these crises, the people say, we need the federal government to step in with militarized police and restore order. And when that happens, well, you've just transitioned from the people ruling themselves back to a centralized government and losing our form of free rule.
Well, you were speaking about screening, and you know sometimes they talk about screening, but countries like Syria are in a state and condition of disarray, so it's very difficult to screen to obtain medical records, police records, health records on those who are coming in from Syria. And of course, we don't want to be unkind. On the other hand, we do have responsibilities to our own citizens to protect and shield citizens as best we can and not to expose them to great peril. You know, I hear so many bleeding hearts, and I guess I do have a bleeding heart when I see all these immigrants, these refugees with little children. Yet, on the other hand, we should have some bleeding hearts for our own boys and girls who are being crowded out of our schools, who do not have proper medical care, who are being exposed to who knows what kind of a disease from the Middle East or someplace else. So it just seems to me, Bill, to be so unfair. And yet, on the one hand, there are some Christians who are saying, well, Jesus would never drive these people out. Jesus would never build a wall. Well, you know, Paul does say that we are to care for widows, but who are widows indeed? In other words, we don't just give free money out without doing any screening, and yet there's none of this being done at the present time.
Well, we have basically two different lines of reasoning in the Bible. One, the most important, is to preach the gospel. The second most important thing is to preserve the freedom to do the most important thing. So once Sharia law, Islam takes over a community, it's the death penalty for you to share the gospel. Once North Korean communism takes over, you're locked in a labor camp if you share the gospel. Once the gay homosexual agenda has their way, they're going to limit what you can say about the gospel. So if you're really convinced the gospel is the answer, you're going to want to preserve the freedom to proclaim the gospel. Otherwise, you're a hypocrite, and you really don't believe the gospel then. The Bible does say a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And so if we're going to leave our kids a country that has the Christian freedom has been taken away, it's bankrupt, it's being overrun by gangs and so forth, are we being a good person that, leaving an inheritance to our children's children? The Bible does say defend the orphan and the widow, rescue those who are unjustly sentenced to death. Why would we bring in gangs that would want to commit honor killings and so forth? So it's, in nature, you see that different species have ways of spreading, and some of them are a way of, a term called parasites. So it injects itself into a host body and then it grows, whether it's a virus or a worm or a tick or something. It lives off the lifeblood, but its goal is to eventually eliminate the host victim. And we, you know, it's like, why is that in nature? Well, ideologically, you know, the people see the bumper sticker coexist. Well, for that to work, each letter, each religion has to teach itself to tolerate those that are not in that religion. So Christianity says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Judaism says, be nice to the stranger because you were once a stranger in Egypt. Even Buddhism has karma. What goes around comes around. You want to be nice to people because it's going to come back around and kick you. Well, Islam teaches submission. There's no verse in all of Islam that says, do unto the infidel the way you want the infidel to do unto you. It has subdue. And so, again, there's a 1,400-year track record. And we see, for example, South Carolina. It's got a great governor, but for whatever reason, this governor has signed on to bringing lots and lots of Muslim Syrian refugees into Spartanburg, South Carolina. Well, the people of Spartanburg, they don't have a say in this. And so we're a government of the people, by the people, for the people. The people should have a say. Now, it's one thing having charity, and that's where people voluntarily decide, I want to give of my money and help somebody. But when the government takes away your money and gives it to people against your will, and usually gives it to those that they think can help them get reelected, it's no longer charity. We have to realize that hospitals were started by Christian charity. Orphanages, medical clinics. I mean, in the 1800s, the government didn't have any of that. It was the churches that took care of all the social needs. Churches can do a really, really good job. And so let people have charity. But you shouldn't force them. One other aspect of immigration, when you go back to look at the Roman Empire, the historian Arnold Toynbee wrote how if that Rome, if it would have passed the immigrants through their schools and not their slums, and if they would have from time to time stopped the immigration so that the people had time to assimilate, Rome could have maintained its civilization and just had all these new you know, cultures added to it, and it would have become great. But instead, Rome fell. So the thought is, how much food do you eat in a year? Imagine if you were forced to eat that in one day. It would kill you. And so food is vital. You need food, but you need it only as fast as your body can assimilate it. And so you need immigrants. You need this new lifeblood, but you only bring them in as fast as you can assimilate them. Otherwise, they bring in such large blocks that they keep their own culture, their own language, their own beliefs, and they do not assimilate, and it ends up becoming the end of the Roman Empire and any other country that has experienced this.
I think as we look at what's happening today, it seems that the refugee resettlement program has been used punitively against critics of this administration. I mean, the assignment of large numbers of Somali refugees to the congressional district of former U.S. Representative Michelle Bachmann in Minnesota, I think St. Cloud. It looks like they're using this refugee resettlement program to kind of club her to death, or at least her supporters.
Right. Well, that process started with Lyndon Johnson. Prior to 1965, most immigrants to America came from Europe, and they had a work ethic where it was considered a failure to receive government handouts. It was sort of considered an embarrassment. Oh, yeah, I know that person's on welfare. But the Democrat, Lyndon Johnson, noticed that immigrants from poorer countries had no problem taking handouts. And the problem is, once you take a handout, you're always going to want to continue it. I use the example, imagine if you were getting a $1,000 check in the mail every week from someone you did not know. Week after week after week, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000. After a few years of this, would you wake up and ask yourself, who is sending me this $1,000 check? I'm going to find out who they are and vote them out of office. Would anybody do that? No, you know, even if you had a conscience, you'd say, well, let me just wait a little longer before I vote them out of office. No, and so once you can get people to sign up for entitlement programs from the government, they will always want to vote to keep those going, and you have permanent Democrat voters. And so Lyndon Johnson and Teddy Kennedy pushed this through in 1965. It was the Lyndon Johnson Great Society Welfare Program. He also noticed that the more inner-city people that could sign up for entitlements, they would be permanent Democrat voters. So prior to Lyndon Johnson, almost all blacks and African Americans were Republican. Lyndon Johnson's the one who switched it from the intimidation that the Democrats did, you know, George Wallace and the Senator Byrd and the KKK, and in 1964, the Democrats filibustered a civil rights bill for 71 days. They didn't want to let it go through. It was Eisenhower, a Republican, that had to send federal troops to force the Democrat South to immigrate the schools. But it was Lyndon Johnson that switched it, and he realized once you could get people to sign up for entitlements, they're going to be permanent voters for his party. And so what we see is, when you mentioned these immigrants being brought in to Michelle Bachmann's district and these other districts, that's the first level is just to change the voting demographics and build a larger Democrat voter base. But the more nefarious is the idea that these are people that have a track record of rioting, and all you got to do is look at these other countries. And so to see, are we potentially bringing in people that would be willing to demonstrate and riot and have an Arab Spring? And so we're seeing like meatpacking plants in Minnesota and Amarillo, Texas, and Kentucky, and Boise, Idaho. They're bringing in large infusions of these immigrants, and they're taking over towns, and they're taking over areas. And Islam is different. Other beliefs and other groups that come to America, they end up assimilating. Islam, because of its Sharia law and your own family will kill you if you leave, they have gone into countries and kept their identity and not assimilated. And so it is anybody that looks at track records in future, you can see we have a 1,400-year track record where the Muslim immigrants move in, and they're nice, and they're so nice. People say they're nice, let more in, more come in. They build communities. They get an imam. The imam says, okay, you need to start following the Quran closer, start wearing the burqas, and then as people see more burqas, they have the same feeling in their gut as if it was gang colors, and they say, hey, the neighborhood's changing, and I'm going to hurry up and move out. And then the property values go down. More Muslims move in, and those that refuse to move out, that's when random violence takes place and there's no witnesses, because no Muslim will testify against a fellow neighbor Muslim on behalf of a kafir infidel who's hanging in the neighborhood. And so shortly after, they end up taking over the whole neighborhood. And once a neighborhood becomes Islamic, it almost never goes back. It always stays, and so it's part of that process of immigrating, increasing, and eliminating.
Well, Bill, it's always been a great, great blessing, and you are a great speaker, a great mind. You have a fantastic memory, and I must say, on behalf of all our listeners, thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you, Larry. It's always an honor.
Marvin, come to the mic and tell our listeners how they can get the special material that we are offering to them.
You can have a copy of this excellent book, Judicial Tyranny, for a gift of $20 in the United States and $22 in Canada. To place your order, just call our toll-free number, 1-800-652-1144. You can also order by writing to Southwest Radio Church at Post Office Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008. Also available is the best-selling book by Bill Federer titled Three Secular Reasons Why America Should Be Under God. John F. Kennedy said that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. You can have a copy of this book for a gift of $15. Better yet, get both books, Judicial Tyranny and Three Secular Reasons Why America Should Be Under God, for a gift of $30. This is a $35 value for a gift of $30. That number again is 1-800-652-1144. Stay tuned over most of these stations for our Bible in the News article on the Watchman on the Wall program from Southwest Radio Church. The Bible in the News is a presentation of Southwest Radio Church. Our Bible in the News article today is brought to you by Pastor Larry Spargimino.
It always helps to look a little more deeply. The real agenda is often not the stated agenda. WorldNet Daily has a report by Bob Unruh titled, Court Told Marriage Fight Really About Targeting Christians, and I quote from it. The case of Roane County, Kentucky clerk Kim Davis is not simply about whether same-sex duos can be married in the state. It's fundamentally about whether homosexual activists can force a Christian to violate her constitutionally protected rights. Close quotes. The brief filed by Liberty Counsel points out that Davis, quote, has consistently argued that there were multiple alternatives by which her undisputed, sincerely held religious beliefs protected by the Kentucky Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the First Amendment, both of which predate and survive Obergefell, could be accommodated while simultaneously ensuring individuals who are qualified to marry under Kentucky law may obtain valid marriage licenses in Rowan County. Close quotes. The real agenda was not the legitimization of same-sex, quote, marriage, but forcing a Christian to violate her protected rights and sincerely held convictions. Rowan County is bordered by seven counties, all within 30 to 45 minutes of the Rowan County Clerk's office. These individuals could have gone to these other counties to obtain a license, but the plaintiffs admitted that they never even tried to obtain a license in any other county than Rowan County. Liberty Counsel contends that the case did not need to be resolved by picking one set of rights to the outright exclusion of another set of rights. While plaintiffs continue to demand unrelenting adherence and submission to their orthodoxy of no accommodation whatsoever, Davis has consistently shown from the outset of this case that there are multiple alternatives by which her undisputed, sincerely held religious beliefs about marriage can be accommodated. Liberty Counsel argued that even to the present time, Kentucky law defines marriage as the union of one man and one woman because the state legislature has had no opportunity to change the definition since the Supreme Court decision. The Bible makes it abundantly clear that until Jesus comes, believers will face situations like this. But the Bible also makes it abundantly clear that there will always be a testimony to Christ on planet Earth. In Matthew 24, Jesus tells about last day's conflicts, but then in verse 6 he says, "The end is not yet." Two verses later, Jesus says, "All these are the beginning of sorrows." Matthew 24, 13 and 14 provides the challenge, "But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved, and the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." It won't be easy. There will be much opposition, but there will be a worldwide witness.
That was today's Bible in the News commentary. You can have the entire month of the Bible in the News articles, the audio portion, as you just heard it, on two CDs for an offering of $14 in the United States and $15 in Canada. To order your monthly Bible in the News on CD, just call our toll-free number, 1-800-652-1144. And you can order the Bible in the News audio on our website at swrc.com. Join us again tomorrow at this same time for the Watchman on the Wall program and a Bible in the News article from Southwest Radio Church.